Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein. This week we will have with us Rabbi Goyen, Rabbi Yeshua Eichenstein. He's Rosh Yeshiva of Beis Aaron. He's one of the great Krovim. He's one of the right-hand people of Goyen Rabbi Aryeh Leib Steinman, the Gadol Hador. It's really a great honor to have him. He's also considered one of the mechanchim par excellence in the world today, both in halacha and in hashkafa. And we're going to be speaking to him about throwing children out of school. And since this is really Matzah Shabbos Chazayin, and it's a time for tears, we will be speaking to Avrami Klein, who is a very courageous parent. His beautiful daughter, Malki, she died just 30 days ago of an overdose. She had been thrown out of schools, shamed in schools, and it broke her. And I, on his WhatsApp that he sent me, I looked, clicked on the picture of him hugging a girl as beautiful as any daughter you ever saw in your life. And he was very courageous to come and talk about it. And it's really, we'll cry together when we hear his story. We will also have Dr. Sivi Yaffin. She's a school and child psychologist. And she's not just a regular psychologist. She's also one of the great Muchassis in the world. She's the great granddaughter of the Rashke Bahag, the Balig Ras Moshe, Ramosha Feinstein. She's the granddaughter of Reb Reuven Feinstein. She is also the daughter-in-law of her husband, is the son of Mordechai Yaffin, the Rashiva of Navardik, also the great Yichis. And she will be speaking about the impact of throwing children out of school. You can find all our programs at headlinestorah.com. or our hotline, 732-806-8700. You could listen to past programs and leave messages. You can email any questions to info@headlinesbook.com. And, you know, I want to tell you that we get a lot of beautiful voicemails, some that are pretty honestly don't agree with me so much, and beautiful letters, and some that don't agree. And if we don't respond, or if I don't respond, it's not because each one isn't fabulous and everybody who writes isn't really have wonderful intentions to agree or wonderful intentions to criticize, which is also wonderful, but it's just that it's just a question of time. But what I do is we post almost all of them on our website. If you go to the Mara Mekaymus, there's a portion afterwards where it's the important emails that, you know, that really say something, the voicemails, we post, like, I would say 70% of what comes in. You can also get it, by the way, on our app. We do that now, too. The Mara Mekaymus, the letters, the voicemails, some of them which are quite entertaining. Next week, by the way, we'll be discussing Aliyah Lahar Habayis, and the fellow we're going to be talking to, who has an organization called Tel Talpiyos. Tel Talpiyos, of course, goes to the Makam HaMikdash, as we say in the Hishana of Yitzhak. And he is a Talmud. He's not some, I don't know, some frothing at the mouth, you know, Zionist from the West. He's a Talmud of Riverdale, 6 years in Riverdale, I believe he said, and Remeya Soloveitchik. And we have to hear the Hislavas and the Ahavas Eretz Yisrael, and he's going to go through the Mitzvahs Yemekayim. And, of course, you know, this is my job here is to point out maybe some of the weaknesses of the argument, what I perceive them to be. And that should be really very interesting. I would also like to, you know, I like to put in an ad. So, okay, here's an ad. Gedalia Levin from Australia. I received the new Headlines book today, Melbourne, Australia. I can't wait to start reading it. Here is an email from Germany. This is incredible. I didn't even know there were Jews in Germany. Here's a letter from Rivka Gurwitz. Thank you for an incredible program. Living here on Shlichus, discovering your program has been a gift for us and our family. We live in Aschenbach, Hessen, Germany, and we listen to the podcast of your show every week, repeating and reviewing past shows. We got both books. It's a huge hit with our family and the many guests that pass through. May you go, Michael Al-Chayil, Rabbi Mendel and Rivki Gorovich, Aschenbach, Hessen, Germany. So I urge all my listeners, if you get the book, you'll enjoy it, your guests will enjoy it, and I, the vain author, will be happy that one more person purchased the book. Before we begin, I would like to say a thought about, you know, period that we're going through. These are bad times for Klal Yisrael, a very painful Bein HaMetzarim, a few days from Tisha B'Av. Notwithstanding, there are people who make huge siyums with feasts, which I think is a getter of novel Brishas HaTorah. This is really a time of mourning. So I would like to say a thought. The Tur in Kuf Nun Aleph, which is also Tisha B'Av, says that, brings Yerushalmi, says that the women are noig, not to deloy lemishti, right, after Rosh Chodesh. So lemishti is a strange word. Some say it means to drink. So the Beis Yosef says no, and the Torah says it means not to weave. And I understand it to be, this is a time, weaving is, we have, you have the vertical and the horizontal thread that's totally disparate, and they're brought together, they're formed into one cloth by weaving. Well, you know what? This is a time when the world unraveled for us. Both, like the Beis Yosef says, the Evan Shesia, is from there the world was woven. The connection between the Olam HaElyon and the Olam HaTachton was on the Evan Shesia. That's where we have El Masaira, where Yitzchak was Nekad, etc. If you look in the Rambam Beis Abchira. But it also means our world, unraveling of the divorces, husbands and wives, fathers and children, unraveling, people get broken, they unravel from this world. This is a very sad time, not a time for parties. So he says, Noig Nogu Shaloy Lemishti, we don't weave at a time when we're supposed to be contemplating the unraveling, the pain comes from unraveling. And you know that the word Echa, the Baal HaTanya says, comes from Ayeka, the first chait. Hashem is Mishalach Bagan, and he says, Ayeka, where are you? Ayeka, where were you? Where are you? And like Moshe says, Echa Esa Levadi, how can I do it by myself? Where are all of you? So the Baal HaTanya says, it starts with Ayeka, becomes Echa Esa Levadi, where are all of you? And it ends with Echa Haisabadad. It ends with loneliness and destruction. If we don't come together, if we don't support each other, it ends up with Echa Haisabadad. You know, there was a pastor in World War II, and he said, when they came for the Bundists, and I'm not quoting exactly, I don't remember exactly his nusach, he said, but when they came for the Unionists, I didn't speak out. I wasn't a unionist. When they came for the socialists, I didn't speak out. I wasn't a socialist. When they came for the Jews, I didn't speak out. I wasn't a Jew. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. If we don't support each other, if we're Ayeka, we turn the other way, we look, we make believe we don't see, it ends up with Echa Haisa Badad. And I think that, I usually try to say a happy Torah, but this is a sad time. And what is the question for Echa? Right? Echa, I ask you and all, where was I and where were you when a child can't get into school and he cries until they're so shamed that they become broken and they overdose? Where were you and I when children are thrown out of school, maybe for non-payment, and we don't march up to the school and knock on the principal's door and say, how can you break and shame a child this way? Where were you and I? Echa, Ayeka, where was I? Hashem is going to say, when you have lonely almanis who never get invited for a Shabbos meal, you have all the singles who sit by themselves by their table and nobody invites them. Well, where were you and I when we have a neighbor who's a fry, a tinnik shenishba, and he's our neighbor for 10 years and we never invited him for a Shabbos meal? Right? Ayeka, where was I and where were you, my holy brother, when a neighbor who can't find a job, his marriage is bleeding from poverty, his children feel like they're in terror, they feel like their world is collapsing. Ayeka, where were you and I? Echa Esa Levadi, where were we as a community? Echa, Ayeka, where were you and I who can spend 10 hours looking for a lulav and an esrig, running to the mikveh, checking on the bugs? We can spend hours checking for bugs, but we don't have the time to read a girl, a shidduch, maybe who hasn't been gone out in 9 months? Hayeka, where were you and I? Why have we unraveled? Why haven't we stood by our brothers and our sisters strong? So this is really a time for contemplation. I think I have to look at myself, and everyone, every Yid has to look and say, are we going to be asked, Ayeka, where were you? Were we Mekayim Shesi Ve'erev Menahush Sasailam? Did we take the message of the Evan Shesia and support each other and lean on each other and hold each other? Or did we just unravel and go our own ways, look the other way, make believe we didn't see? That's what the Torah says, the message of Tisha B'Av is. Let's go to the phones. We have some really fascinating guests. We have the great honor of having with us, from Eretz Yisrael, one of the great mechanchim of our generation. He's the Rosh Yeshiva of Yad Aaron. Rav Volba made him the head of the Vad Chizuk in Eretz Yisrael. He's a Yad Yamin of the Rashke B'Hagra, Baron Leib Steinman. We would like to welcome Hagoyin Rav Yeshua Eichenstein. Welcome, Rabbi Eichenstein.
Hello, good evening.
Rabbi Eichenstein, here in America, there are schools that if a child underperforms, they will throw the child out of school, or alternatively reject the child so a child is left without any school to go to. As recently as 2 weeks ago, there was a little girl, a young woman, who died of an overdose. She had been kept home for months because there was absolutely no school that would accept her. And like her father said, when she got the rejection letter, she just fell on the floor, curled into a ball, and cried for days. What are the rules? What rights do a school have? When can they reject a child? When can they throw a child out? Please give us your halachic das Torah on this.
Well, let's try to go first the source of the problem. Today, in today's world, anybody that's not connected to learning is in the danger. The street is a street. People are drawn to the street. And something has to draw you to learning, to Yiddishkeit. If there's nothing drawing you, positive, so everybody today, any child today, any adult, young adult today who is in a danger. That the street is very, very moshech. It draws people into it. So we have to always see if the people are connected, the children are connected to the learning. And if they're not connected, we have to find a way to give them a certain geschmack in what they're doing. Otherwise, there's a tremendous danger today. So when a child does not fit into the normal framework of the school, so we have to understand that there's usually a problem involved in it. It might be a learning disability. It might be something psychological. We have to try to understand what is going on. Why is this child not fitting in? And if there's such a thing, we have to understand what we could do to help the child. It's very easy to throw somebody out of school. The question, what we could do to help the situation. There's usually a reason behind it. There's not somebody just not acting properly. There's some reason usually. And the reason usually is they're not connected to the learning. It might be because they're capable enough to be excel. They feel themselves under par. And then maybe they're drawn to other things. So you have to see how to draw them back.
But what do we do? So now we have a child who's just not succeeding. Scholastically, they're not succeeding. And
we have to find them some type of framework where they'll be successful. We have to either make certain learning things for them that they could be successful, find the right school for them if this school is too hard for them, but not just to throw out. We have to find what they could do. Everybody has its capabilities. We have to find the right place for this person.
So let's work with that, continue that, okay? So now you have a child, and the child is learning, cannot keep up with the class. So the principal and the teacher say, look, they can't. So the parents come and they say, well, what can you do for our child? And the principal and teacher say, look, we have limited means. You know, we have a budget. We barely make budget. We could be behind an hour of AM. We do not have the capability to coddle your child. And
what
therefore,
happens,
We want you to take the child out. We do not have the money to the facilities. This is not a fancy school. It's a simple school. It's not keeping up. So we think it's very high sounding and very proper sounding. We just don't have the ability. So please take your child out. Which is what would be the next step?
Let me take that. But where, did they say where the child should go to? Did they try to help where the child should go? Maybe it's enough to have a tutor for an hour a day that could bring the child up to par. Did they try that?
So,
was it offered to the parents?
How much effort does a school have to make? Like, in other words, here's the debate. One bystander says, you know, it's atzalus nefashis. So, you know, on a mitzvah, I say, it's ad chaymish minachasav. They tell the school, you know, you have atzalus nefashis here. And another person says, well, what's a school supposed to do? They don't have the resources. So I know I'm asking sort of like a down in the, you know, like a nitty-gritty question. At what point do you say the school is...
How much could the parents...
...right them, or the school is not? Like, what's the limits?
How much would it cost to try a tutor for an hour a day? Maybe that would be sufficient. Maybe that's sufficient.
So let's say it would be two or three hours.
The parents pay part of it, and the school tries to pay part of it.
Okay, and let's say the parents can't afford it, or they.
So let's try to
happens?
Make a certain appeal for it. If the child is suffering, and they didn't say where to send the child. They found a school for the child. They say where this right school would be. They help the child to get into another school.
And let's say they don't. If they don't help, would it be wrong for the school then to throw the child out?
I think so. You can't throw a child out without having a place where to go. The Chazini said it's like taking somebody in a boat and throwing him to an ocean. Today's world, you take a child out and you throw him out of school without finding a place for him. The Chazini said it's like taking a child and throwing him to the ocean.
So let me ask the Rav a question. It's almost like a gram ritzicha, right? So let me ask you a question. This happened to me very recently. Two parents came to me. Their daughter was in school, and the school has a no-drinking policy. Very common in America, unfortunately, there's drinking issues. And the girl had a few friends over, and it was Matzah Shabbos, and she took beer out and she served it to all her friends. And the school said, we have a zero tolerance policy, and they threw the girl out of school with no place to go. And I called up the principal, and I said this Chazenish. I said, the Chazenish said, you need a Bezdin of Gimel to throw somebody out. I mean, you're killing. They said, we have to protect the other children, and therefore, no drinking is our policy. If a child is caught drinking, they're out on the street. How would the Rav look at something like this?
I wouldn't agree with that. I would say you have to know how to enforce your rules, but you must find a place for the child to go. You can't throw somebody out without finding a place. Unless you know definitely it's such a type of mazik that is ruining other children immediately. If it's only a question of school policy, you have to know you have to find a place.
There's
always a place for somebody to go to. Just not throughout in the streets, Tom.
And would the Rav say then that if a school throws a child out in the street, Stam, that according to the Chazenish, they're karev to being it's karev to a ritzich, it's throwing somebody off a lifeboat?
I don't want to say karev to ritzich or this, but it's the wrong thing to do. You must find a place for the child to go.
So let me ask the Rav another, Shaila. I had a girl came to me. It happened, a boy and a girl, because, you know, two different unrelated people. The girl was in a girl's school, the boy was in a boy's school, that they called in, they went to by the boy, he was in first grade, and he said, the principal came in, he pointed to six boys, he said, come to the lunchroom. And he said, in the lunchroom there were boys, two from this class, one from this class, all of whom's parents had not been able to pay tuition. And the principal said, you're all going home until your parents get paid tuition, and they were all sent home. The girl was actually kept out from the beginning of the year through Hanukkah till her parents finally raised the money. And the boy said it was the single most embarrassing thing that ever had to happen to him in his life. He said it changed his look forever on, you know, Yiddishkeit, on schools. Now, the schools, on the other hand, say, well, if parents don't pay tuition, we're going to close down. How do you deal with this?
I wouldn't do that to the children. I would tell the parents. You don't do that in front of the children. You don't embarrass children that way.
But what happens when the principal says, we've told the parents didn't come up with the money, if I can't, don't get tuition, I won't be able to pay my mechanchim, if I won't get my mechanchim, ultimately, the school could, you know, without, but if there's no budget, things could choke. So I have no choice but to demand,
I don't
send the kids home.
I wouldn't agree with that. There's a problem, so you have to solve the problem, but you can't embarrass children in such a way. I wouldn't agree with that, no.
And has the Chazinish or Baron Lev, have you ever discussed a question like that with them?
Not about tuition. In our yeshiva, we never throw somebody because they don't pay tuition. No such thing.
In Eretz Yisrael in general, would they throw people out for inability to pay tuition?
Not to my knowledge. I don't know. I can't say for all yeshivas. I say in our yeshiva, we'd never do such a thing. Never.
Is there any heta because of as a Rav and a Paisik and a Adam Gadol, is there any heta to embarrass even at a child, is on a child too, because of non-payment? Do you see a halachic standing of somebody saying, look, I have no choice, my school will close if I don't enforce the collection policy,
I would never embarrass a child, no. The child is not at fault for that. How can you embarrass a child for such a thing?
And would the Rav say that if somebody does embarrass the child, it says kilu hargai, I believe the Aruch Lener in Binyan Tzion says it's Yerek Val Yaver, it's a Taisus in Saita. Would you think that it rises to the same level with the child too?
There's no difference. You're allowed to mevayish a child der chinuch, but you're not allowed to mevayish, not der chinuch. You're allowed to mechiyach like this, but it's not der chinuch. It's a problem of the school. So what's the heter to mevayish a child such a way?
So let me ask the Rav another question. When you have teenage daughters that have left high school, and they're not in seminary, and they're in the workforce, and the Rav started the conversation by saying that every young adult is in danger today, the street is such a powerful magnet. What do we do with the boys are in yeshiva, okay, the girls who are working, they're not in seminary, they're not in high school, the street is on fire. How do we keep the girls connected?
In my opinion, the seminaries, I was at Matzia, the seminaries in Eretz Yisrael, and they're doing it. To keep a contact with all the girls. A few times a year have certain get-togethers, a Shabbaton together, to work with the girls, to keep a contact with the girls. Not to let them just leave the seminary and you forget about them.
And I started doing it. What could a parent do if the school doesn't do it?
And the parents have to have a very, very warm home and make the home attractive to them.
And how would you do that? Give us a few ideas.
The Shabbos should be a real Shabbos. And that there should be an atmosphere, a good atmosphere. A good home is the best thing that there is. A warm, good home. You should feel comfortable at home and want to be at home, not just raise up in the streets.
Let me ask the Rav. If somebody, Rahman al-Islam, and it's unfortunate, but I guess it was always like this, there are children who go off the derech, right?
Yes.
Give us some guidelines for parents how to deal with children that are off the derech. Now, there are children who are off the derech that are respectful, and there are children that are off the derech that are very disrespectful. Give us some guidelines how to deal with them in both cases.
I don't want to get involved with the question of, they say, love without boundaries. But I think the basic thing that parents have to deal with the children, that child has to feel not the parents are embarrassed with them, and that's why they don't want them at home. That's the worst thing. When a child feels, you're not worrying about my good, just I'm worried about their neighbors, your friends, and this and that, saying, oh, you have a child off the derech, oh, what's wrong with you? That's the worst thing that there is. A child has to feel he's loved, the parents want him to be good, and they'll do their best to try to make the best of him. If the child feels the parents are really not interested in his good, just embarrassed by him, that's the worst thing.
So let me ask the Rav, you know, we by nature, we're very social animals. Like the Rambam in Hilchos Deos says that if somebody sees the neighborhood is bad, yelech lemidbaris, because we are affected by our neighbors. So if somebody does have a child that is off the derech, that is dressing inappropriately, that is being mechal Shabbos, and they are very, very embarrassed. How should somebody deal with this embarrassment, which is very real and very painful?
We have to understand that being embarrassed is not a reason that the child should go off the derech further. A person has to feel that this is his child. He has an achrayus. The question, the big question is, when the parents feel it's ruining their other children, that's when the big problem is. But just from embarrassment, you just can't throw a child out of the house. For embarrassment. If he's ruining other children, that's a big question already.
I mean, look, I just want to tell the Rav Yitzchak, I'm sorry, Rivka, right? She always kept Esav at home. She
had a son like Yaakov.
And she sent Yaakov away in the end, and she kept Esav at home.
Yeah.
So she was never embarrassed. She never let that pain cause her to send.
Because of embarrassment, you can't tell a child to leave because of embarrassment.
Rabbi Eichenstein, it's an honor to have a mechanech of your stature on. We have thousands of listeners that will listen carefully and absorb, and I hope the mechanechem, there's been, unfortunately, so much pain and so many suicides from overdoses, etc. So I would like to thank you on behalf of all the listenership for contributing your time.
Okay, Alevaya should only be a tellus and shouldn't be any nezik.
Amen. Thank you so much.
Okay, kol tov should be a lot of atzlocha.
Amen. Kol tov.
Kol tov.
We have on the phone with us from New York City, Mr. Abe Klein. I believe you're in Borough Park or Flatbush, Mr. Klein?
Borough Park.
Borough Park. Who recently had a tragedy in the family, and this is obviously a very highly sensitive issue, and he's very courageous, and I believe doing a great public service and talking to us about it. He lost his daughter in tragic circumstances, and welcome, Mr. Klein.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about your daughter, Malki, and, you know, her life and what happened? Share with us.
Malki was a sweet neshama. It's a little bit, you know, in hindsight, it's a little bit more difficult to talk because I mix up past, present, and future due to being more knowledgeable today. But she grew up, she's our number four in a family of five. And she went to Beis Yaakov, the same place as her sister went, the older sister. And as young as I think it was age four, one of the teachers pointed out that we should take her maybe for evaluation. I'm assuming they saw something off to a little degree. And they told us to take her to an evaluation to the Board of Ed. And we did that. And the Board of Ed, they basically said, oh, she's going to grow up to be running for public office one day. But they approved her for what's called P3, which is, I guess, some additional funding for the school so they can add like one-on-one services, et cetera. Well, I think they call it resource room. That was at a very young age, and everything was fine. At least that's what we thought. When she was a little older, we had to do that again because they approve it, I think, only till age 5 or 6 easily. And at that time, I had to write a letter. And because from the school's perspective, from our perspective, she needed a little extra help, a little extra push. So they provide resource one-on-one. In addition to all that, throughout her years, we always help provide her with tutoring, etc. It happens to be that when she was in, I think she was 6 or 7 years old, she was in the beginning of second grade. One Friday night when she was sitting at the Shabbos table, all of a sudden she just like blurted out saying, my teacher says that I belong in first grade. My wife and I looked at each other in a way, really not knowing how to respond. Master Shabbos, my wife called the teacher and asked her, how dare you? But that was the extent to what we did. And from our point of view, we were hoping at least that this comment went over her head. We did not know that 15 years later she'll still be talking about that comment.
How she was in second grade at the time.
That was the beginning of second grade.
And the teacher said, "You belong in first grade."
And she said it in front of the whole class. Eventually, as she grew older, and at age 14, she grew out of that particular system, and she needed to get into a high school. She had a very difficult time to get into a high school. Her report cards, which is a prerequisite, you know, for the next school, did not say much. And she had a hard time even getting an entrance exam or interview, whatever they called it at that time. And finally, she was accepted to a school, very special person that was a principal at that school. That principal knew our older daughter. I think she was her teacher or her principal at an earlier time in Bisyakov. Accepted her into that school. It was a relatively new school. And she was registered way in advance, you know, before the summer. The initial tuition paid, deposit, whatever they call it. And she went off to camp. We knew that she has a school and everything is great. Moving back the clock a little, she had a teacher that took great interest in her and really showed her that she believes in her. And they became very, very close. And she did extremely well in eighth grade, in a relative basis, but extremely well compared to earlier years. And she one day got up in the middle of a class, she stood up and she said, "I am a new person. I am going to perform. I am going to be somebody different than whatever you know about me in the past." You know, she made like a whole announcement in class. It was cute. So she was accepted towards the end of the winter into that school. And right after Sukkot, we were called and we were told that she can no longer, just a couple of days, I mean, 3 or 4 days after Sukkot, that they cannot hold on to her anymore. They threw her out. They threw her out right there and then. My wife and I left. We ended up doing some errands and stuff. By the time we came home, my daughter was already home. As a matter of fact, all her books were thrown around the den. She was on the floor, and we thought that she is dead because there was no movement. We didn't know what's going on. I went over to check if she has a pulse. And I found her that she's sleeping on the floor in the den. I'm assuming she cried. I don't know what happened. She cried to a point where she just fell asleep, to a deep sleep. That was the end. She called, our daughter called this principal, and we overheard part of the conversation because we heard her talking in the room. She was crying and begging, and saying, "I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you. That you're going to see. I'm going to do. I'm going to try." It didn't go very far. The next day, someone told us to go to Mask and talk to Rahama Klapman. I don't know if you're familiar with her.
She's been on the program.
Yeah. And we went to Mask, and my wife and I, just to see how they can help. I had no clue. I never heard of Mask in the past. That maybe they can help. So we went to Mask, and we told her the whole story, basically whatever I just said, maybe in more detail. And I remember she picked up the phone and she actually called that principal and she said to that principal, "I just want you to know that if you don't do something about this, you will have blood on your hands." She then made a phone call to someone else. She was starting to tell that other person something, that we got to find a school, we got to this, we have a child at risk. And my wife and I were looking at each other. We had no clue what this woman is talking about. We thought that something was wrong with her. What do you mean a child at risk? So she doesn't learn that much. She's cute. She's sweet. She's everything. She does. And one of the things, every time my wife went to PTA, you know, throughout the years, and the teachers are saying she doesn't follow along so well. Yes, the extra help helps and all that. But in class itself, she has a very hard time following along. But they always said but one thing. She never disturbs in class, never. And my wife always came home being happy, saying, you know, she's so good. Whatever, how bored she is, she doesn't disturb. And she behaved. She was very well behaved. So we just completely didn't understand what Rahama was talking about. Eventually, I think the next day, maybe, I think my daughter met the principal in a pizza shop or something, because she said she was trying to talk to her and make it good. Because Rahama told her, you must talk to the girls and do something. Anyway, they spoke. I don't know what they spoke, but nothing happened, came out of that. And for 3 months, basically, she was not in the streets. I mean, she was home, had no school. She kept on wearing that school uniform because she was so embarrassed that anybody, and she liked fashion. A school uniform was not her first choice of dress. But she walked around with a uniform. She walked around with a school uniform more than when she was in school because she needed to make a statement that she has a school. It's only then that one of the people that tried to help us out, it was one of the Askanim. I mean, a lot of people were trying to figure it out. One of them said, take her for an evaluation. And they suggested a doctor in Queens. So we did. We asked our daughter if she wants to go for evaluation. And she says, anything that's going to help me get into a school. You know, which for she went for an interview. And she went to that school, and she was there for the rest of the year. It was about Hanukkah time. She did very well, but she worked very, very hard. She, 24 hours a day, literally, besides sleeping itself, 24 hours a day, she was busy with school. It was school and homework. You never saw her without having school paperwork in her hands. She came home from school. She didn't even eat dinner at home. She grabbed her dinner. She made herself a schedule every single day, about two or three or four tutors every single day. She went to camp. Things were happy. I think she went to Camp Aguda at that time. And she came. And when she came back, she said, I really would like to go. That's not the school I wanted to go, or no, I want to go. They didn't want to accept me to begin with. And she just had, it was, things about it were irking her, and it was hard to understand. She went to schools by herself. She actually went to school. She wrote herself a note. It reads as follows. Please hear me out. Before telling me no, for the best reasons you may have, please at least give me a chance. It doesn't matter who somebody may have been. It matters who they want to be. And who do I want to be is the best that I can be. I want to grow and change and work harder. I want to see what I'm capable of because I bet it's a lot. Most importantly, I want to go to, and she names the name of the school, I want to go to this school more than I've ever wanted anything. I'm not a faker, and everything I'm saying right now, I really mean it. Please, Rabbi, please give me a chance. Please take it into consideration to accept me for the 10th grade. I know school starts in less than 2 weeks. But in 5 seconds, anything can happen. Thank you for listening to me. So between Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, she kept on talking about she can't. She said, you know, whatever other kids do in seconds takes me hours. I got to work my butt off to get things done. I just can't. I can't do it anymore. And, you know, I gave her encouraging words to the best of my ability. And pretty much, Erev Yom Kippur, during the first Suda, she came to the table and I saw a different picture. I saw a girl without a skirt, being somewhat let's call it progressive. I didn't say a thing. It's in my house. No big deal. That's where she should be feeling most comfortable. You know, maybe she just decided to come to the suda with pajamas. That's the way I looked at it and said, I'm not going to say anything. She basically was wearing leggings. And she ended up going that afternoon to my older daughter. She lives in Lakewood. And she put on the skirt and she went there for Yom Kippur to help out with the kids. After Yom Kippur, she came back home the next day. My wife actually had an appointment with her to go to a life coach or something, which she had the next day after Yom Kippur, and she just came without a skirt, and that's the way she was going to go to the life coach. And obviously, the first reaction was like, okay, this is not just at home. This is something new, something real. Eventually, she went to an alternative school for girls that don't have schools, the girls that look a little different, behave a little different, dress a little different, run by some very wonderful people. I mean, we had the discussion one time about using drugs and stuff, and I asked her to please explain to me, like, why I was talking about the danger of using drugs. I said, like, what does it do for you? I really wanted to take interest in everything she does and everything she feels as much as possible. So one night we had a discussion. It was like 2, 3 in the morning. And I asked her, I said, do you know how dangerous it is? I mean, this is not pharmaceutical grade. This is, you never know what you're buying. You never know what you're getting. And she says, I know. And I know that I'm playing with fire every day, but that's not the issue. The issue is that doing the drugs allows me to live, because without it, it makes me numb, and without it, all I do is think and think and think and think and think, and it creates a lot of pain. And I responded to her that time saying, oh, Malki, I really feel your pain. And I think I even said it in this particular voice. And she lashed out at me. She said, no, Todd, don't you ever, ever say that to me. You don't know what it feels like. You cannot feel my pain. Do not remember one single happy day in my life. You saw me being happy. You saw me smiling. You saw me going to friends and calling friends. And all that was a lot of work for me. It was a facade. It was a show. It was trying to overcome my inside feeling, and that is all I remember. And then whatever happened, for one reason or another, I knew she's in a slump. I knew she's down, because about a week earlier, she FaceTimed me, and she started crying. She was talking again about, everybody around me are overachievers and I'm an underachiever. And at that day, she was crying. She said, it's 4 in the afternoon. I didn't even brush my teeth yet. Because that's me. I couldn't get out of bed this morning feeling so down. I just couldn't get out of bed. It's 4 in the afternoon and I still didn't brush my teeth. So I knew she's not in a good state, but she was relatively okay compared to other times earlier. So I made sure when she came home, I made sure to have a Narcan kit in the house, just in case. And that Thursday night after Shabbat Chalas, through Mamash, a miracle because of a package, it's a long story, that came and I saw it by the door, so I wanted to go up the room to give it to her. And I found her in a terrible state, and I quickly, and she was basically OD'd, and I quickly grabbed the kit and administered the Narcan. And Baruch Hashem, at that time, she went within a few minutes. She came back as if nothing had happened. Actually, Datsola was here within a minute, and they started seeing that the pulse was coming back and breathing is coming back. And at that day, I was actually looking to find a doctor, because she said, you know, I need someone to prescribe me with Suboxone. I need someone to prescribe it right now. So I don't go there again. I was looking all over the place, reaching out everywhere to find a psychiatrist or somebody that licensed to prescribe it. We couldn't find anybody. We finally got an appointment for Monday, and she was very, very nervous about it. And it was 5 minutes before Shabbos. She asked Tao, what's going on with the Suboxone? I said, I'm still trying. She said, it's not going to happen because it's right before Shabbos. None of your friends are going to pick up the phones or do anything right now. I said, don't worry, there's people still working on it. And then Friday night, and eventually she went to her room, and then a friend came, a close friend of hers, and spent with her all throughout Friday night until 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Was here. She didn't feel that well because she was more in a withdrawal state because of the Narcan. She had the shivers and she just wasn't feeling that well, and she wanted to stay in bed. And but the friend joined us at the meal, and the friend left at 5 o'clock. I went to my shir in the afternoon, which was 6:45. I didn't even know the friend is not here. I decided not to disturb her, knowing she has a friend here. So I went to my shir, but I found out later, because about 6:45, I went to shul, and about 7:15 or 7:20, whenever it was, I was called, or 7:30 it was, from shul, that she's not responsive. And I came running home, so I got the call at the same time. I tried to do the same thing again, but the moment I walked into the room, I saw this is different than the one I saw on Thursday. But she walked out of the house at roughly 6 o'clock. She came back 6:30, whatever, just within a minute or two after I left the shul. She spent time with my wife. About a half an hour, they were sitting and talking, and she was together, chatting, until she left and she went up to her room. My wife went up to her room 20 minutes later or so, just to say goodbye, because she was going to go to spend some time with a neighbor. And when she saw her in that state, and this time around, we were not able to bring her back. And that's the end.
What would you say to the principal who threw her out of school? If she was listening, what would you say? Or if he or she was listening, what would you say?
The only thing I can say today, the only thing I could say, you know, there are times that these days, by nature, I'm not an angry person, but there are times during the day that I have a lot of anger, other times a lot of pain, or I think anger with pain, sadness. There's, you know, I have all different kinds of feelings going through my mind, my body, my heart. And I tell you honestly that whenever I'm in a place of anger, I really don't like to talk to people. Simply because whatever I would say, whatever that I could say, I really don't want it to come from that place, because I don't think that anything coming from that place will actually bring any positive results. It becomes more of a screaming, yelling, argument match. Everybody tries to be right. I don't want to be right. I don't care to be right. If I can, I would like to be able to make a difference. What I would say to the principal at a state when I'm not angry, and I'm not right now, is to say hindsight should teach you to better educate yourself. A whole lot of other kids going through your hands. It says, Megalzon Schisai Dazak Evchevet Aichayev. Heed those words. Do whatever you can for you not to be the chayev. That's my only message I have.
And what would you say to the other principals of so many schools who send kids home for non-payment and maybe could keep kids home for months? I've seen that, unfortunately. I saw it in Lakewood too many times. Or to principals who throw kids out of school, maybe they dressed the wrong way, maybe they did. What would you say to those principals?
I really think it's not an issue. I very much believe in Klal Yisrael. I said, Mikam Chesul, it's so true. when we see issues that we can identify, when we identify with issues and we relate to those issues, there is no nation, there's no people that respond to a crisis like we do. Bar none, the world responds to an earthquake in Haiti and they start feeding people. They don't have what to eat all year round because that's the only way they respond. We feed people all year round. We make programs of tikkunas chasanas so people can afford to marry off kids. We have moises that charge so little they can barely survive because Kanayinahara, we have large families. And we are a people of chesed. That's who we are. So inherently, I truly believe that everybody means well. I just think that people are terribly misguided. And what I would tell people, what I would tell principals, and I would tell parents really, is you don't have to wait for a crisis to go learn something you might not know. I would especially tell it to principals and mechanchem and mechanchos to never think that they were born to be mechanchem and mechanchos, that it's in their DNA. There is a lot more to learn of how to deal with kids that are not running on autopilot. Kids that need extra help, kids that need guidance, kids that we need to be their GPS, those are the kids that we need to concentrate on. The rest, they're turning out to be whatever they turn out to be. As I once heard someone say, despite of what we do, rather than because of what we do. We need to concentrate on the kids that are trailing behind because those are the ones that need our help. And unfortunately, we don't because there is principals, the yeshivas, schools, they serve the masses. And the masses doesn't have the problem. There are the few that have the issues. And the systems are built to work that way, and therefore the other ones don't survive. And what I have found, and I've gotten to know Malki's friends, I have found those kids to be extremely smart, extremely bright, extremely intuitive, all of them deep thinkers, highly sensitive, ultra sensitive. Every one of them, each and every one of them, they process and process and reprocess information. One word, one bad word, one time telling a child in second grade that they belong in the first grade, they never, ever get over it, ever. It makes them feel stupid for the rest of their life. If Hashem gave that person a particular level of resilience, they can withstand that. They will remember it, but they will overcome. But for those that don't have that immune system, and the immune system is not that great, those fall apart. Those are the kids we lose. And some of them get to a point where they just can't climb out of it. I'm going to add something to that. What would I tell principals in schools? Do some introspection. Try to wipe your slate clean from everything you know, from everything you thought you know, from everything you believe you know. Do introspection and find out maybe there's a whole lot of things that you don't. Because the moment you'll start searching, you got the mitzvah, you will find a better way how to do things.
Rabbi Klein, thank you very much for sharing this. And I hope that we have, you know, there'll be tens of thousands of people listening to this. And I hope that the schus, maybe you will save another child's life. Maybe you will, some educator, some parent will be wiser and there'll be one less broken child. And may that schus be for the memory of your beautiful daughter, Zechana Livracha. Malka Bas Avram Shalom. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We have with us on the phone from Chicago, Dr. Tivi Yaffin, who is a child psychologist as well as a school psychologist. She is also a great-granddaughter of the Rashke Bahag, the Baal Igros Moshe, or Moshe Feinstein. Her grandfather, Pablo Ben Achaim, is Reb Reuven Feinstein. Her father-in-law is Reb Mati Yaffin, the Rosh Yeshiva of Beis Yosef, of Navardik. So she's both erudite in the secular world, as well as comes from the really the greatest house of godless B'Torah. It's an honor to have you with us, Dr. Yaffin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So, Dr. Yaffin, we just had on a parent whose child died of an overdose, and the parent told us that very recently, 30 days ago, how when the child was in second grade, she was called stupid in front of the class by a teacher. She couldn't get into a high school after, you know, effort, rejection and rejection, and it broke her. And my question is, like, why is that different? I know that I'm an adult and I get turned down by lenders, by regulators all the time. It's like, you know, like I like to say, the default is rejection, right? Yeah. The exception is when things go well, right? So, like, and I pick myself up and I move on. So, and yet we have kids, and we had Rabbi Zvi Gluck, he said there were 100 kids this year who committed suicide or died of overdoses. Like, what's wrong with the children? Like, why can't they just pick themselves up, brush themselves off, and move on?
Well, you know, as a child, you're still in, you know, development of a person's self and psyche, and being rejected by the school, which is reflective of the community, reflective of their socialization, it leads to a really profound sense of rejection and also a sense of disengagement from anything meaningful in their community, a sense of fear, isolation. There's so many more components to it than just being rejected from the school. You know, like you were saying before, if an adult gets rejected from a specific lender institution, it's separate from their sense of identity and their sense of self. Okay, this person didn't buy into my ideas, but when a school rejects a child, they're basically saying, you know, we reject who you are. We don't want you to be a part of us, a part of our community. You're kind of left out to float, and they feel very unattached, alone, unsure about where they're going to end up in the future and where they belong.
So as a child psychologist, talk to me about the damage that this shaming can do to a child.
Well, shame has always been found to be very negative to the development of healthy social and emotional health. It has never had any positive results. It doesn't lead to learning. It doesn't lead to growth at all. Although, you know, sometimes it's the old-fashioned method, but it doesn't lead. And, you know, shame can also, a child who feels very shame might become very defensive, very self-protective. And in a self-protective manner, they might harden their hearts against whoever they felt the shame from, almost like saying, you know, if they don't want me, I can either feel embarrassed and upset about who I am and what I represent, or I can say they're the ones who are crazy, and it leads to a lot of self-destructive behaviors because you're trying to say, I don't care about anybody around me. I'm going to do whatever I feel like right now to prove that, you know, I don't need their approval. I don't need what they say, because once they accept that what the other people, the school, the community feel about them is rational and true, then they have to say, well, they don't want me, so I'm bad, I'm unwantable. They might go into self-harm behaviors and other, you know, dangerous behaviors.
So when a child is young, are they more vulnerable than an adult?
Well, again, as a child, there are plenty of adults who might lose their jobs and, you know, have a very difficult time rebounding. But children is even much more sensitive because, again, they're developing their sense of identity and sense of self and where they belong and who they are as a person. And being rejected by the community, being rejected by the school, which represents where they belong, their community, first of all, like you said, it's extremely shameful because everyone now knows they weren't good enough or they were a bad kid or whatever, however this plays out for this particular child. But also, they don't have something to grab onto, like, I was able to accomplish this so far in my life. I have this. This is who I am. This is what – they're still developing all those ideas. Who am I? Where do I belong? What can I accomplish? And being rejected from such a major part of their, you know, community and life, and, of course, from their friends, therefore, it's very hard for them to bounce back from that and then to also continue to form their sense of self and identity. It's very disruptive to that process.
So would you say that the old nursery rhyme that we used to sing, Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall, Humpty Dumpty had a great fall, all the king's horses and all the king's men, couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. If we let the little child get shamed or broken, it's very possible it can never be put back together again?
You know, I don't like to say it can never be put back together again. I think that shame, again, is a very damaging, a damaging influence. It can really disrupt the real formation of a child's sense of self and who they are. So, yes, I think it's very harmful. It's very painful. It's not something we should use ever as an educational or pedagogical approach. That said, I would hope that a child who is at that point where they've been shamed and harmed and broken to that extent, that there are things we can do to help them come back. It's just a very lengthy and arduous and difficult process, and if we can avoid getting there in the first place, obviously we'd be much better off.
So what would you tell a parent who the child comes back from school and is being shamed at school? And I guess it goes beyond shaming. It could be shaming. It could be both either by peers, bullies in school. It could be by teachers. What would you say what would you say to a parent? What should a parent do in that case?
So I think it's very important to recognize that, you know, I don't think schools or educators go into school into their careers with the idea of, you know, I'm going to shame kids to make them behave. And I don't think parents send their kids to schools with the goal that they're going to get shamed. But sometimes something just kind of goes wrong in the process. You know, schools want to do their best for the kids. Hopefully that's the goal. But sometimes they have a child and they just don't know what to do with him. So I don't want to tell parents, you know, go fight with the school, and that's going to create a very, you know, negative interaction pattern, and it's going to just escalate, and that can also come to the child's at the child's expense. But what I would say to the parents and to the school is, we're all here for the child's benefit. So if something's going wrong, and that can happen for so many different reasons, but there always will be a reason. Children do not misbehave because they think it's fun. And even if that's what they think that they're doing, there's always something driving that misbehavior. So I would say to the parents and I would say to the schools, if you need to, reach out to outside resources, but sit down together and think. Think about this child. Think about who they can become. Think about what their challenges are. Think about what you haven't explored yet, and come up together with a plan that the goal is to help this child. And obviously, we're not always right. And sometimes we try something and it doesn't work, and then we have to try something else. And sometimes we need to call in the experts, and we need to really explore psychologically, emotionally, socially, behaviorally, what's happening for this child so that we can create a plan that will help them.
Now, what would you respond to? When I lived in Lakewood, there was a girl, she lived on my block, and she went to a high school in Lakewood.
Mm-hmm.
And it was run by a very prominent Oskin, one of the... And I went, and they kept the girl out of school for months.
Why?
And because her parents could not afford to pay tuition, so they sent her home.
Oh, wow.
And I went to the Manahol, right, and I said to him, I said, why would you keep a girl out of school for so long? She sits on the floor and she cries. And he says, look, Mr. Lichtenstein, if you have a tenant who doesn't pay, do you send them home? Well, this is my business. So just like I don't tell you to keep tenants who don't pay, please don't tell me to keep girls who don't pay. How would you respond to that? This is my business, and that's
okay.
Your business.
In every institution, there are always different levels of operation. You know, there's the level that has to worry about on the ground, day-to-day. How do we interact with the children? How do we teach them what they need to know? And there is the level of how do I keep my school functioning, and how do I make sure I have the funds to pay my teachers? So it's not that I don't understand the rationale for what he's saying. Again, though, when we take a step back and remember, our business is the children. You know, it's easy for me to say I'm not the administrator making the fundraising, but what I would probably say to him is, you're right, the parents are responsible, but she's not. She's not the one who's responsible to raise the money and get herself to school. So yes, you have to get something happening, and maybe you can involve community members that know the family, and maybe you can involve the rub of their shoulder. I don't know exactly, but I would say to him, she's suffering. And yes, you might think, oh, because she's suffering, the parents will. But sometimes that's not the case, and they say, okay, whatever, eventually they'll give in. But in the meantime, this child is suffering shame and rejection and confusion, and she's losing out on learning, which is tremendous in terms of her long-term educational prospects. I would say to him, listen, let's get her back in school. Let's work with the parents. I don't know what the answer is, but she shouldn't be the one, I think, to suffer.
And but he says, listen, this is my business.
Mm-hmm.
The school is a business. I have to keep it. So you don't want to keep your tenants, or you wouldn't let in the grocery somebody not pay. If the child doesn't pay, they're out. This is, you know, I'm in business like you're in business.
Well, again, you know, again, I understand his need to keep the school running, but it's not a business per se. Schools always operate at a loss because it's a community service. You're helping raise the next generation of our community. So, yes, you have to keep your business in the green and make everything operational, but I would say you're right. It is a business, but the business is helping our kids grow and learn. So, yes, sometimes you're going to have to sacrifice the bottom line for the best interest of a child. Now, we don't want this to become a pattern. If it gets out that kids are getting away with this, obviously that can lead to a really big, you know, more global problem. But in specific cases, at specific levels of need, we might have to find another way to convince the parents they need to pay for their tuition rather than having their child be the one to suffer the brunt of the shame and displacement.
And what would you say, one last question, to a principal who I went to just recently, the last few weeks, they threw seven girls out of the school. They said, listen, we have to protect the reputation of the school. And if we have a child who, this child was caught drinking beer with a few friends at home on a Matzah Shabbos or another night, he said, we have a zero tolerance policy. We have to protect the reputation of the school. If the reputation of the school is harmed, other girls are harmed, and therefore we have no tolerance. You're out. I don't care if you can't get into a school. You can't get out. My job is the reputation of the school. How would you, as a child psychologist and a school psychologist, how should I respond to this principal?
Okay, well, I have to first say that, again, I have zero tolerance for zero tolerance. The research has been consistently showing that it is an ineffectual type of response to misbehavior. It oftentimes is not fair or appropriate for the misbehavior. You know, like, again, in the case that you're mentioning, maybe these might have been A students, but if you have a zero tolerance policy, you might suddenly have seven less students. Research, National Association of School Psychologists, American Psychological Association, even Pediatric Association and American Bar Association, everyone's coming out very strongly against these types of policies, as they are against suspension and expulsion, because they just don't make sense. So the first thing I would say is you can have rules, and you can even have consequences related to rules, but to have a zero-tolerance policy is just going to lead to problems like this, which don't make any sense and are not relevant to what the child needs or what your school needs. The second thing I would say is absolutely you have to protect the reputation of your school as being a place which makes sure that every one of your children is taken care of and becomes the best foster child or adult that they can possibly be. So, I mean, I personally, and again, you can answer back to this if you don't agree, would think that a school that suddenly kicks out seven girls in 1 year has a lot more to answer for than a school who says, I have seven girls who made a big mistake, and I'm going to work really hard with them and their families to make sure this doesn't happen again, doesn't become a part of who they are. So, you know, what's the reputation? He has to be clear in his beliefs and his ideals, what the reputation he wants to have is.
Now, as a school and a psychologist and a child psychologist, are you surprised that it can drive a child to suicide?
I'm not surprised at all. Like I said before, that when a child is expelled, they have it's a profound sense of rejection. It causes an identity crisis, a sense of loss, grief that I'm not part of the social setting, the community setting. They don't want me. There's something wrong with me. Oftentimes, there might be an underlying issue. Either it might be an emotional issue that becomes much more exacerbated by this, or a learning issue that now the child feels hopeless, I'll never be able to get better because now my school, which is supposed to be helping me with this, is saying, we don't want to have anything to do with you. So a child who is expelled now is facing so many internal conflicts and crises at the same time that they're trying to figure out what the next steps for them are. So they're almost like in crisis mode, but they also have to be more clear-minded than they ever have been in the past, which of course is impossible. So we're really, it's a terrible situation to put a child in. I think I can't say, and I would never want to say a blanket statement, there's never a place. I can't answer to that, but I can tell you that it's such a profoundly and it's such a harmful thing to do to a child.
Dr. Yaffin, is it fair to say that the Gemara says that a Beis Din that killed somebody more than once every 70 years was called a Beis Din Katlanis? Is it fair to say that a school that throws out seven kids a year or just repeatedly throws out kids, could we compare it to a Beis Din Katlanis?
So I don't know enough about that to say, but I do know that what I've always said in school, schools I've worked in and to myself and to my peers and colleagues is every single child we kick out of a school or that gets kicked out of a school that we work in, that's a failure on our part. That's not a failure on the child or the parents or the community or whoever else. It's, as a school, we are obligated to service the needs of the children who come to us. We are now their, you know, parental system, you know, outside of their home. And if we cannot give them what they need, we're the ones who failed, not them. So absolutely, I would think it's a reflection of the school's ability to meet the needs of all their children. Everyone can teach the sitting still, most well-behaved children.
Dr. Yasin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I would like to say that my goal is not, chas v'shalom, to attack educators. I think that the vast majority of mechanchim are very special people who love children, who live for the most part really close to poverty. I grew up the child of mechanchim. We never had what the business people next door had, and they're holy people. So it's not to humiliate, chas v'shalom, to attack. I think that the mechanchim, we should salute them. In fact, I'm always the one who says that when it says that before we start sending money over abroad for all kinds of tzedakis, you know, all we should be making sure the mechanchim get a raise, an extra check, right? I believe that we trust them with the most precious thing we have in the world, our children, right? So my goal here is more to create a conversation, awareness, maybe training, but not chas v'shalom. Don't come away from this and saying he's attacking mechanchim. There's nothing holier. Mechanchim are mamish de mizbeach. They are supporting the tinaikish shel beis rabban. But can we do a better job making them more aware, some of them who maybe are ignorant of the tremendous powers that they have over children who are just forming? That's my whole goal. Chas v'shalom, don't come away from this with anything else.